reaction to the decision by Netanyahu not to send an Israeli delegation this week?
I got to tell you, Steve, we're kind of perplexed by this. A couple of points that need to be stated and, in fact, restated. Number one, it's a non-binding resolution, so there's no impact at all on Israel and Israel's ability to continue to go after Hamas. Number two, as I said in my opening statement, it does not represent a change at all in our policy. It's very consistent with everything that we've been saying we want to get done here. And we get to decide what our policy is. The Prime Minister's office seems to be indicating through public statements that we somehow changed here. We haven't. And we get to decide what our policy is. It seems like the Prime Minister's office is choosing to create a perception of daylight here when they don't need to do that. So again, no change in our policy.
Yes, folks, Left Reckoning 162, Matt Leck with David Griscom. Hello, David.
How's it going, brother?
It's going well, and that was a little bit of honesty from a chief liar of the American government, John Kirby, not about the non-binding stuff, which, you know, I'll just reference former guest of the show, Heidi Matthews' thread here. For March 25th, if you want to go into the legality there, that's just, you know, but a little bit of honesty with regards to, look, we haven't really changed in policy here. We need to squawk a little bit and pretend like we hear people because that's the, you know, currency, but we're with Israel every step of the way here. And also, even more bluntly, with regards to these international law structures, we decide. As Kirby says, we decide when we want to listen to them. We decide when we want to go to them to sort of like rouse up support for a military invention here or there. But ultimately, look, they're a vehicle and we can discard that vehicle and, you know, use our own vehicles anytime we want. So, yeah, John Kirby there. And of course, we'll get to more with Ben Case, who, you know, makes the case for this being a colonial massacre, objectively speaking. So, you know, no loss for what we're going to be talking or time for spent on Gaza today. Yeah, that's just John Kirby there. The sort of thing where like, a lot of statements that if you're trying to collect footage in the 80s for like a Noam Chomsky documentary, it's just like, yes, we definitely need to cut and record that. But you're just hit with it from like four different people at that exact same podium every day. It's something else.
It really is, you know, something else. And, you know, as a reminder, as we'll talk about with Ben Case in just a little bit about why it's so important, you know, to get the facts right, you know, on these kind of things, because I don't know, this just like, do you even call it misinformation, Matt, what we're getting from the White House other than, you know, it's like,
well, it, no, exactly. I mean, that's the key point. Actually, the Robbie Martin interview, we talked about this, is what is the anxiety with misinformation? Is it that it's going to create a mob that upsets the power structure, or is it that the power structure is going to use it as license to basically dominate the world? That's my concern. Like the vials of anthrax or the weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. What is that misinformation doing? Down to hysteria about doctors doing late term abortions or trans people going too far. Like what is it licensed power to do? That's my concern with misinformation. Yeah.
You know, but it's just one of those things when you see the statements that are regularly coming out, from the Biden administration, from our government, you know, it's always really shocking. For example, when you have like the Biden early on saying that he doesn't trust the numbers coming out of Gaza. But also, it sometimes is even more interesting when they are sitting there telling the truth, you know, like Kirby, in the way that they're trying to portray the way that the United States views one as a relationship with Israel, but more importantly, with the rest of the world and international law.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the one weird thing about this, these press briefings at the White House is, you realize that, I mean, very often, I think maybe I'll overgeneralize, liberals think that they're being the one spoken to here. And sometimes you got to say things for your buddies in Israel over like maybe the platitudes of like, look, we're all in this together. We're trying our best. Here's what's that guy? Jason Sudeikis's character. The coach, Ted. Here's Ted Lasso talking about mental health and how we all need to support it. Right. Sometimes you need to cover for a genocide, like, you know, and it's probably a little bit upsetting to certain people. But yeah, exactly. That jerk Kirby has to say, look, fuck the UN. We're still America. They can come at us if we want. We're still America. Relax. Okay. We need to like show a little bit to folks. But again, our policy has not changed. The policy written into the most recent budget, which is to stop funding the one organization that could really do something about starving Palestinians at the moment. We're just going to not fund that for a whole year. And, you know, occasionally one of our different Matt Miller, or someone, he'll get a tear in the eye when he gets a question about Palestinian children. But relax, BB, we are not changing policy. Mm-hmm.
Well, we'll have a lot more on that coming up with our conversation with Ben Case. I do highly suggest people read his piece that he co-wrote. It's the links is there below, but we'll jump into that in just a minute, because there's something else that we need to talk about up top, which is about just this horrendous disaster in Baltimore. And I mean, where to start here? I mean, maybe we can start with some of the fallout and the facts to get us going here. Great piece from a friend of the show, somebody you should be listening to, reading and following, Darna Noor. In The Guardian, where they write, it seems impossible Baltimore residents grapple with bridge collapse. And here's a photograph of this just a devastating image of a boat that crashed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge late last night, or I guess early this morning, around 1:30 a.m. Eastern time. Darna writes, across Baltimore, residents were struggling to make sense of what had happened after waking up to the news of the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge, one of the city's main thoroughfares. It seems impossible, quote, said Reginald Jones, a 67-year-old Baltimore resident. The bridge crumpled into the Patapsco River like a house of cards at 1:30 a.m. on Tuesday after it was struck by a giant cargo ship leaving the city's port. Maryland Governor Wes Moore declared a state of emergency shortly after, and the Maryland Port Administration announced on the suspension of the vessel of vessel traffic into and out of Baltimore's port until further notice. And Darna goes on to write about, you know, the experience of people in Baltimore reacting to this. One thing that's very important for us all to note here, the search is still underway for at least six construction workers who remained unaccounted for on Tuesday afternoon. According to the Maryland Transportation Authority, they were working to repair potholes. Jesus Campos, a construction worker for the company Bronner Builders, said the workers were low-income immigrants from Central America and Mexico. Their labor helps them support family members here and abroad. He himself worked the overnight shift on the bridge until 1 month ago when he transferred to daytime hours, saying, I quote, it's a difficult situation. My friends were working on that bridge, he said, speaking through a translator. And, you know, there's a lot we can get into about the fallout here. But first up, I think that it's really important to note that the immediate casualties, you know, we don't know what the final tally is. We don't know if maybe these people can be are going to be recovered or missing still. But as of, recording here, 6 p.m. Central on Tuesday, it looks like six people died in this accident and drowned, very likely. People who were repairing potholes on this bridge. And I know I'm not the first one to say it, but I think it is very notable that as we see all these really disgusting attacks on our neighbors, our friends, and our family from the right wing, talking about migrants in the way that they're talking about, the victims here are people coming from Central America, to work and to provide incredibly important and necessary services to all of us, the people of Baltimore for sure. But these are folks in every community, and those are the people who, bear the brunt of the disasters that we're seeing, unfortunately, more and more of in recent years.
Yeah, I mean, we have this other piece from Baltimore Banner. The Maryland Transportation Authority said that the construction crew was we should go over the details for people who didn't see this. We're not going to play it, but unless it's in the Max video. But basically, like last night, I saw this as I was going to bed. The cargo ship lost power. You can see the lights go out of it and drifts right into one of the pillars, and the ship goes down quick. Now, the reports are that a Mayday signal was sent to the bridge authorities, so you can actually see some traffic moving along the bridge as the ship sort of drifts into it. And from what I can tell, those must have got off, and it appeared so. And like the entire time watching, it's like, please, no more vehicles, come on. And so it's not surprising, like now knowing that none came on because that Mayday signal got to those, but it did not get to those workers in the potholes. And you know, it's just, I do think it's resonant. Especially like all these anti-immigration convoys driving on roads maintained by whom, really? Mm-hmm. You know, that the automobile has taken in, like the sort of American psyche, and who's actually maintaining that stuff in America or in North Dakota? There's a bridge, Fairview, I believe, into Montana near the upper north, actually very close to where Sitting Bull was ultimately taken in by authorities, northwestern part of the state. This bridge that my family growing up, homesteaders in the late 19th century, they would used to walk across, had all these stories. And I later found out that actually there was a lynching of a black man around that time, and it was a guy who was up there building that bridge. So like this sort of like this infrastructure of this country, not to mention, you know, Chinese labor to create railroads, like it's very depressing. The amount of like the actual like bodies that people just drive on all the time, and we don't really, and we just fundamentally, and we're maintaining a system that keeps people like this that are coming to try to, I mean, do these vital jobs, so important. Like you literally every day you interact. Oh, there's a pothole. Who do you think fixes that? And then it's you actually zero in on the people's lives, and they're being oppressed, and they're kept in a certain status that makes them exploitable to the point where, yeah, they're not the ones getting the Mayday signals in a situation like this.
Yeah. And again, you know, there's a lot of reports coming in about, you know, for example, people who've sort of been recovered since, worries, for example, that, you know, folks might not feel comfortable interacting with first responders or things like that, just because of the environment that we're in right now in this country. But just on the kind of fact finding aspect of it, you know, as you were saying, Matt, what we know now is that the cargo ship, the Dali, which is not an American ship, went down. Its power went out multiple times as it was exiting the port, and effectively lost control of the ship, which then rammed into the Francis Scott Key Bridge, destroying it. And you know, I think that there's a lot to be said about infrastructure in this country. The lack of investment, the lack of care, but I think that just like the fundamental reality here is it doesn't matter when that bridge was repaired or built, a big ass tanker driving into it is going to destroy anything. And like, again, I'm not an expert in, seafaring or anything like that. So I'm not going to comment, for example, on like, what I don't know about, for example, whether or not, you know, safety standards were met. It does seem that this boat, has had issues in the past with passing inspections. They also seem to have been in an accident in Antwerp in Europe back in 2016. Go ahead, Matt, you had something?
Well, I've read all that stuff too, and the failing of a certain number, two inspections out of 27 in the past decade or so. And to me, it's like, I have no way to contextualize that.
Yeah,
how many
exactly
of the cargo ships are that bad, right? Is that par for the course for pretty much any of these giant things you see floating around, or is that exceptional? I genuinely don't know.
But beyond that, I mean, like the fact is like if this was a kind of frequent offender or not, the fact is that you put a machine like this, and the, you know, if you, you'll see, we have a video from that I took from Max Alvarez, editor in chief at the Real News Network, a friend of ours, that we'll play in a second, where you can see from a distance how large this boat is. But just for people who might have never seen tankers like this, I mean, these are just massive. You know, these are massive, massive boats. And like having something like that have an electrical failure any point in time is, you know, extremely dangerous. And, you know, I think that it's important for us on the left to be able to try to make our critiques like accurate and grounded, which is why I just think it's important to not sort of just sprint to whatever comes to your head at first. But there's no doubt about it that, for example, we're seeing shipping as something that, one, the global economy is ever more reliant on. And it's something that there's regular failures in, as we remember, very famous ones recently. But the, you know, the increase in incidents, you know, is something to be noted about the way that we sort of monitor and manage these systems, both in the United States and abroad. As we've seen, you know, global shipping, you know, regularly find itself in, you know, in really, really dangerous positions, right? You know, and this is something that has massive effects on people's lives, livelihoods, and just the economy in general. But before we get there, and we're going to get to the right in a second, somebody asking in the chat, how long is it going to take for the right to blame this on DEI? Well, we'll get there in just a minute. But before we get there, I did want to play this clip here from Max Alvarez at the Real News Network. Why is it doing that, Matt? Can you get it up here? Are you able to?
There okay. It is. I see it.
There it is. What remains of the Key Bridge in Baltimore. We're standing at Fort McHenry. You get a really clear view of the wreckage. My God. The whole middle is gone. The whole middle of the bridge is gone. And I just spoke to Jesus Campos, a construction worker who worked for the same company that employed the crew that was on that bridge when it fell. So far, 6 workers remain unaccounted for that we know of right now. It was about midday on Tuesday. And from everything we can surmise and from what Jesus himself told me, those workers, as far as we know, did not receive the message of the Mayday call from the ship. Cops blocked off traffic both ways, preventing more casualties. But from everything we can surmise so far, no one told the workers. And many of them are still missing.
Yeah, and as you know, we have conversations about all these other effects of, you know, what this is, what caused it. I think it's very important right now, especially on the day of, to be able to, you know, have your heart and think about the families and the people, you know, directly affected by this tragedy, you know, and recognize, as Max sort of notes there, it's like, no, they were not warned in time. They did not get that Mayday call.
Yeah, I mean, that will be a pressing question, is what systems are set up in such a contingency. I mean, I crossed the Chesapeake Bay Bridge Tunnel going down to Virginia last fall. And I mean, terrifying, but it was often like there's a lot of different safety, different like things going on. I don't know. Yeah. One wonders if they even thought to, okay, maybe we should have some protocol in place in case we do have a Mayday to let these workers know, or if they just thought, that's just guys filling potholes, so who cares?
Yeah, and I could be wrong about this. I think that like when it became clear, for example, that this was going to hit, I think it was, matter of seconds, I think about 30 seconds that's or true, something yeah. like that. And I think from one of the reports, I think, you know, there was a kind of recognition that there were people on the bridge, but there were calls that like, you can't, like if you go out there, but anyways,
it's
a recognition though, but 100% that like, you know, these are, you know, things that might feel routine, like doing maintenance on a bridge. You know, these are dangerous jobs that should have things like baked into. I mean, if you worked any kind of job, you should have safety standards that prepare for even the unlikely kind of situation. Absolutely. And it's an absolute tragedy to recognize that these folks were not included in that May Day there. And this is a report from USA Today on the ship. Baltimore Bridge collapse wasn't first major accident for giant container ship Dali. Propulsion failed on the cargo ship that struck the Francis Key Bridge in Baltimore early on Tuesday as it was leaving the port, causing it to collapse into the frigid Patapsco River. Its crew warned Maryland officials of a possible collision because they had lost control. An official speaking on condition of anonymity confirmed to USA Today that the DHS cybersecurity infrastructure security team is working with the federal, state, and local officials to understand the potential impact of this morning's collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge. It is likely that virtually every pilot in the country has experienced a power loss of some kind, but it generally is momentary. This was a complete blackout of all the power on the ship, so that's unusual. Of course, this happened at the worst possible location. The ship is in Tuesday's crash. Dali was involved in at least one prior accident when it collided with a shipping pier in Belgium. That 2016 incident occurred as the Dali was leaving the port in Antwerp and struck a loading pier made of stone, causing damage to the ship's stern. According to VesselFinder.com, a site that tracks ships across the world, an investigation determined a mistake made by the ship's master and pilot was to blame. So again, we don't know the full extent, what systems might have failed. We know the electrical system. I mean, like what kind of regulation systems failed, what kind of piloting systems failed, what amount of this is like human error. We'll wait to hear from everybody, all the reports that are coming out. But there's just no way to get around the fact that this is extremely devastating for the people in Baltimore, even more devastating for those families. And it has, spurred some extremely nasty and reactionary discourse. It is just something that is truly amazing to me time and time again. Like, no one's surprised by the right wing. But it is incredible to see how culture war is... so advanced in this goddamn country that something like this, can happen and you already sort of have these reactions. So somebody in the chat had mentioned a couple of minutes ago, how long is it going to take the right to blame this on DEI? And we're rich in examples. A lot of them just saying things like, posting the image of the ship going into the Francis Key Bridge and saying DEI in action. Right. So I don't know if that the bridge is woke or diverse. I don't know if the idea is that it's a foreign ship. It'd be very interesting to see these big brains try to come up with a way to do American empire and American capitalism without doing some level of foreign trade. I don't know. Is it Pete Buttigieg being the transportation secretary? It's one of those things is incredibly incoherent and nasty. And I think this, though, might be one of the nastiest examples of it, which is from a pretty large account here, 276,000 followers. I am yes, you are no, who tweeted, quote, "This is Baltimore's DEI mayor commenting on the collapsed Francis Scott Key Bridge. Is going to get so much worse. Prepare accordingly."
I will note that these, scumfuck racists never use their actual image in true. Their profiles. Like, if you loved yourself, if you loved your race or whatever, I mean, that's not why I use it. I like it because I'm vain and I think I look good. Show yourself. Show yourself, pussy. Oh.
100%. I mean, but the fact is that one, I think, they want to be, hiding around. And two, these are just direct consequences of the reward system on Twitter. This is somebody who's going to get a lot of attention for this. We're giving it to them. But yes, we'll talk about the fact this is something that is sort of encouraged on this platform under the leadership of Elon Musk. And these
participated
boys
feel- in. Yeah. Like if you look at Elon's likes, I think Matt Binder had a tweet out. Like, I mean, he is just a Nazi. I mean, not that this should be that shocking. I think you could read between the lines in some of the things, but like, no, he's like, out there like in the dumb, like this stupid, not like dumb shit.
Mm-hmm. Oh, 100%. But also, let's be very clear. Let's just play this clip for a second, by the way, Matt, just, you know, so there's no confusion here about what this person means by DEI. This is the mayor. Early in the morning, right?
Sorry, I did notice some people mentioning his outfit here, and it's just like, first of all, nobody else, like, what are you expecting to put on a fucking tie? It's fucking, it's right.
Not only that, but are you kidding me, Bubba? It's like W was always in, you know, the Air Force One fucking jacket. You know what I mean? It's just like these. Yeah. Anyway,
everyone, this is a unthinkable a tragedy. We have to first and foremost pray for all of those who are impacted, those families. Pray for our first responders and thank them, all of them working together, city, state, local, to make sure that we, everyone.
No, I mean, there's nothing there. So what they mean by this, by DEI, you know, is that the mayor is black. And that's pretty much it. And I just think that it's very important for people to sort of recognize that, you know, this, like, it's not even subtlety at this point. It's saying, no. you know, a black person in any kind of position of authority or power is because of a program that people just sort of learned about, it seems like 9 months ago, by the way, that is set up to protect large corporations. DEI, for the most part, is set up to protect large corporations from lawsuits. But
yeah, I mean, what I think has happened, I mean, they literally said the Boeing stuff where the doors are flying off is because of black pilots. It's become a new way of saying, hey, I'm a racist. Racists, come give your attention to me in this attention economy. Tim Pool's all over that shit. But I do think the shift from DEI, or from wokeness to DEI. So, like, first I'm anti-woke, but now I'm anti-DEI. Mm-hmm. I think that represents a shift in the conservative content makers who they're talking to. They're not talking to the funders. When they say DEI, that's not, they're not really even have an eye on what audiences broadly think. They're talking about, like, executives. Dave Rubin will be explicit about this. He's like, they'll come and try to diversify your board. Like, and he's saying to you, he's talking to a increasingly narrow and more elite audience. And that's what's happening with this DEI stuff. But it is what it obviously looks like, which is, I'm a racist. Let's blame this on, let's spur up sort of white paranoia and fear up around this stuff. But I do have some other, this Carl Baer has collected some
thank
examples.
You, Jesus Christ.
Here, so maybe we'll take a closer look. Look, we want a steel man, right? We don't just want to over.
Well, wait, just before we go any further, it's just like, We talked about this event at the beginning, and try to bring some, you know, some, not just analysis, but also, like, here's some things that we should be thinking about. And I think it's a very clear example, which is we should be thinking about these workers whose lives have seemed to be very likely lost here. Make sure that those are the people who folks are thinking of first. But it's amazing when you have a big event like this, it's like going to get filtered through everyone's wild thing. And, like, some people are going to say ludicrous things. Some people are going to say, oh, from my perspective, I'm thinking about this. This is, you know, we just talked about the right wing and DEI. This is going to be a very interesting walk in another person's shoes.
Yeah. So here we go. I'm going to do this here. First, we got the jet wrench. Would Marxist Democrat scum kill those people and destroy that bridge just so they could rename it after someone other than the writer of the Star Spangled Banner?
Hell yeah.
You bet your ass they would. And I love that idea. Like, bro, we could just rename the bridge. You know, we don't need to.
Imagine having, like, an orchestrated and powerful terrorist, like, an organization, right? That is, like, capable of undertaking massive attacks on the United States of America, using it, not using it to take over or to put yourself directly in power, but using it to force them to change the names of bridges.
If I'm Joe Biden, I'd be like, look, I agree that we should take this tanker and crash it into that bridge so we could rename it after the guy who wrote the Star Spangled Banner because it includes racism. I agree with it. Do it under Trump, okay? Wait until it's not my fucking shipping that's going to get impacted, right? I'm trying to go into election season with a good economy, all right? Let's think this through a little bit. The renaming needs to, we need to priorities, folks. Okay. All right. Here's another one. And some of these might be really objectionable, but I apologize if I didn't catch them earlier. But anyway, here is Liz Churchill. I'll be the first to ask that CNN and everyone else stop showing the video that's quoting Baltimore mayor does not want people to see the collapse of the bridge.
Oh,
sorry.
Here
I'm in the way.
Dumbass alert.
Sorry. I'll get out of the way. This is a communist controlled demolition. Now, I'll just say I don't think that's why the Baltimore mayor said. I think it's more out of like, this is a gesture that we can make towards the people who are still fucking missing, that we don't engage in this sort of sensational
to not footage and turn this into like, you know, a mass casualty event into like a meme.
Yeah, or like, yeah, have QAnoners. Here we go. Craig Lind, I'll hide myself again here so we can enjoy this.
Oh, boo.
When they finally clear the harbor, God only knows with Pete Butt stuff. So there's your Pete Buttigieg thing, as you correctly predicted. The bridge will not be rebuilt. We no longer have the capacity or national will to do such projects. Our key infrastructure is mostly World War II and Vietnam era, and the communists are busy destroying it. I love this one because this is kind of like almost, this is kind of horseshoe theory. Like what we're talking about with the leftists who are too knee jerk saying like, oh, but like we've covered crappy bridges on this program, but to say like, oh, this just proves us right about this. No, here's the thing. We can still build bridges, motherfucker. Like, what are you talking about? Bridge projects are completed all the time in this country. We're a leading industrial nation. I don't know how conservatives are so insane that you think we can't even build fucking bridges anymore.
But I mean, beyond it, the idea that the communists are the one blocking it. I mean, what group in this country is the one that doesn't like it when we do social spending? Do you know which one? If you were to trying to teach a kid, like, hey, what's the group that doesn't like it when we spend money on large public projects? I'll tell you which one it's not. It's not the communists.
It's a, you motherfucker.
Do you know what the right likes to do? Do you know what the right likes to do? They like to have those things being owned by private interests and by capitalists and not by the public. Yeah.
Here we go. We got another one here. This is Scott Barley.
Oh, yeah.
Here he says, if you have read Atlas Shrugged, you know that this was all easily predictable. Just now it's parts falling out planes instead of trains, but the bridge collapses remain the same. Damn, Scott Barley, indeed. But the bridge collapses remain the same. It is an inevitable result of putting corrupt, socialist, educated elites in charge.
Wait, so how do they get into how do they get in charge?
Atlas Shrugged, David, obviously, you know, which, you know, I have read Atlas Shrugged, long ass book, where John Galt decides, like, look, you want to regulate my steel invention that actually is really strong and could stand up to any sort of testing and regulation that you wanted to. But anyway, you're corrupt and doing so. I'm going to take this to like some valley and
if only there were no regulations, then the bridge would definitely be really, really strong. That's
yeah, exactly. You
know, if there were no government regulations on government projects,
I wonder if it was
the bridge
a private,
would be so fucking strong.
who relayed the Mayday? Was that like the private bridge authority, or was the Maryland private Department of Transportation,
or the private police who shut down?
Right.
Shut down traffic, right? No.
I think this is actually like a pretty good, like seeing what I saw going to bed last night and, you know, seeing that actually like, okay, thank God there was less traffic on the bridge because of Maryland Department of Transportation, you know, I don't know.
Oh yeah.
It seems kind of like maybe we should take some things for, you know, thank, I don't know, God or Allah for some of this, but.
No, I mean, It's what I mean. I will say that, you know, I know what Biden's trying to communicate by saying that, you know, the federal government will pay to fix the bridge and blah, blah, blah. Do these companies not have any responsibility? for floating a big fucking tanker down the middle of American point. Harbor and destroying our infrastructure. We're just gonna
because
be like,
guess
yeah,
what?
We got it.
These tankers are not getting bigger because that is a safer thing to do. I think anybody who saw happened in the Suez Canal, see, like, actually there's some downside risk, some externalities, should we say, to these giant things getting bigger. Because why? Because why? Is it because of DEI? Or is it because of profit? Once again, like, yeah, racism being just blatantly used to cover up a failure of a profit-seeking industry.
Oh, yeah. Well, we'll have more on this in the future. I mean, there's some other wild rabbit holes we could go down, but maybe we'll save that if we want for the post-game. I want to switch over to Gaza and our conversation with Ben Case. This is a really important bit, and I do highly suggest people read the story below. There's links to it. Where Ben, along with their co-author, investigate the mass slaughter of Palestinians by Israel. And they sort of question the framing of this as a war using social science. I think it's a really important bit to understand. Not just, I think, like most people, I think, understand the tragedy, the injustice of what's going on. But I think actually being able to speak about it in a kind of factual scientific matter, to say, like, look, this is what this is, definitionally, allows us to go into conversations a bit stronger, for the folks who are like, well, you're just emotional about this. But fuck, you should be emotional about it, first of all. But two, the facts are very clear as to what's going on here.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And for anybody who, this is very important for cross ideological discussion, right? Like this sort of criteria, objective criteria for what is a colonial conflict? What is a massacre versus a war? And if you have a problem with that, then you have the problem with a mountain of scholarship that preceded this precise moment. And I think that is, and we also have a good discussion about this sort of inertia, should you say, of the editorial class and what they're willing to publish and when and how you get them to publish certain things. That's why, we have this piece linked and share it, especially with people who you think might need maybe fetishize a little bit of objective approach. Because I think, Ben and his co-author, really, this is an important service to the extent that, academics can provide it. This is it.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So enjoy this conversation. Then right after that, Matt and I are going to be in the post game. We'll be taking questions from y'all along with some other fun clips. We'll be hanging out a little bit. Patreon.com/LeftReckoning and get access to that. But without further ado, here's our conversation with Ben Case. Welcome back, Left Reckoners. David here, joined by Matt Leck. How are you doing, brother?
I'm doing good, David. Good to be with you.
Happy to have you here, man. And we're really excited to be joined by our guest today, Ben Case, who is a return guest on Left Reckoning. We're going to be talking about something a little bit different today. We're going to be talking about Gaza. But maybe before we dive in, Ben, do you think you could introduce yourself to the audience who didn't catch you in the first round?
Sure. Yeah. Thanks for having me. So I'm a postdoctoral research scholar at the Center for Work and Democracy, which is a union-funded labor center that's based at Arizona State University, doing research in a bunch of different directions that are meant to highlight the struggles of working people and contribute to working class power. My own background as an organizer and as a scholar is actually in some different areas than what I study now, but my current research is about ballot initiatives and the use of ballot initiatives as part of class struggle. So I write articles about that. You can find me in Jacobin and elsewhere, and I'm working on the book now. But previous to that, my research is more in the areas of political violence and the ways we talk about violence and nonviolence in movements.
Mm-hmm. And I think that this, you know, this issue obviously is very important in this conflict. And, you know, I'm just going to put up the article. People can find a link to read the whole thing. I do suggest folks do it. But it is what's happening in Gaza is not a war. It's a massacre. And I mean, maybe just to sort of set us up, could you maybe, you know, just on the most basic question, why is what's happening in Gaza right now not a war, right? It's typically the way it's, you know, the news is like the war in Gaza. So why is it not a war in your reckoning? And two, why is this distinction a kind of important thing for people to understand?
And I would just add on to what David's saying. If you look on Wikipedia right now, which is a kind of a pretty central arbiter of what these things are called, it is the Israel-Hamas war.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, that's a term that gets used pretty ubiquitously by whatever side folks are on now, and not just for this particular round of violence, but for previous bouts of violence between Israeli government and Hamas. You know, on some level, it might seem like splitting hairs. Obviously, in common usage, we can use the term war to mean all kinds of things. But if we want to actually get clinical about the differences between warfare and other types of political violence, the terminology, I really think, is significant. Because it leads to people to have different perceptions of the conflict. I mean, there was a poll recently that showed that a plurality of people in the U.S., can't answer the question of, you know, if more people have been killed in Gaza or in Israel, right? And part of what contributes to that is this terminology like war, which has this, it implies a contest of arms between roughly equivalent forces. And that's not what we see. And so, the idea behind writing this was to try to ground discussions of the violence that we're seeing in empirical reality. It's excruciating watching this from afar, feeling like we can't do anything. But from whatever side folks come from on this, if you're paying attention, emotions are understandably heightened with the level of violence and the type of violence we're looking at. That can lead to all kinds of misperceptions, especially when you introduce all the misinformation that's out there and the slanted information that's out there. And so, debate is important, but we have to ground that in facts. We have to ground that in some sort of agreed upon reality. And when it comes to this conflict, I mean, it's always the case with warfare, but when it comes to this one, it's as though if you talk to people in different spheres, it's almost as though they're talking about different dimensions of reality, right? They talk about the same conflict completely differently. And of course, there's different narratives, there's different opinions, there's different histories. That's all very important. But there's also an objective reality that's happening on the ground. And so the goal of this was to try to push ourselves to find what's the most accurate terminology for what's happening. We started as my co-author and I, and by the way, he's at the Stimson Center. It's a foreign policy think tank in D.C. that works with the Pentagon. This is not a left-wing institution at all. And he and I, we don't agree on everything about this conflict either. But what we do agree upon is the need for some grounded reality and the terms we use. And so the first thing we did is both as social scientists who study political violence is try to say, how do we categorize what we see? There's all this conversation around, whether or not Israel will be convicted of genocide in the International Court of Justice, ICJ, right? That's going to take years to litigate, and it will be important. But in the meantime, what clarity can we offer as social scientists? How do we define this? And so we went about that by looking at some of the industry data sets that categorize different types of armed violence. And some of them, the Correlates of War data set is the main one we looked at, which I can talk about in detail if you want. But, they differentiate wars. They catalog wars going back to, I think, 1817. Up to 2007, and they have certain categories that you have to meet in order to be considered a war. And so we took the numbers that we could agree on, the sort of objective facts that we could have some basis for thinking are real, or at least minimally real, and we sort of plug those in and see where it comes out, and it, on all the criteria. Basically, it doesn't meet the threshold for what we would call war. A massacre is a more appropriate term. And I'd be happy to talk about the factors we look at.
Yeah, I mean, maybe to set this up. I mean, just for someone who has a layman, this term colonial massacre. I mean, so you're talking, you're looking at these kind of data sets. Is this so much a question of comparing, death tolls on each side, who the combatants are, who is being killed, or are there other kind of categories that we're thinking about, like the status of Gaza, to sort of come up with this term, colonial massacre?
Yeah, so we look at three empirical features of the conflict. We look first at the political status of the two sides. Second, we look at the fatality numbers on both sides. And third, we look at the dynamics between soldiers and civilians on both sides. And so for the political status of the two sides, when you look at the data set on war, they have different types of war. So if we're saying, okay, let's start by saying, if this is a war, what kind of war is it? So there's three initial categories. There's wars between states. So think like Russia and Ukraine. There's civil wars, wars within a state. So different factions of our government fighting for control. You might think of Syria in recent years or Libya before that. And then there's extra state wars, or a war between a sovereign state and a non-state entity. And those are then split into two subcategories. One you call an imperial war, and that's a war between a state and a non-state entity outside of the control of that state. So basically a state trying to capture territory from some other, from an area that's not controlled by another state. And the second category is called a colonial war, which is a sovereign state fighting against a non-state entity in a territory that's outside the borders of the state, but that's controlled by the state. Right. And so first trying to categorize this there, we would call this a colonial war. So Israel is a sovereign state. Hamas does not have recognition in the international system as the government of Gaza. The Gaza Strip is a territory that's outside the recognized borders of Israel, but with the territory that's entirely controlled by Israel. Israel controls the borders, the coast, the airspace, and the trade. Can determine what goes in and what goes out. Egypt, of course, controls one of the borders of Gaza, but in allyship with Israel. If Israel bombs Gaza, Egypt does not consider that a violation of their sovereignty. So, Israel has complete control over the territory and is fighting against a non-state entity in Hamas. So clinically speaking, we would call this a colonial war if it was a war. And that's significant on the face of it, because the term colonialism gets thrown around a lot in this conflict, and it should. And we should debate all the implications of that historically and into the future. That's all very important. But you actually don't need to get into all that in order to say this is a colonial conflict. That's just what it's called, again, in the way it's categorized. And in fact, the correlates of war data set, the main one we use, the last bout of violence between Israel and Palestinian groups that is in the data set is the Second Intifada, which started in 2000, which is in fact categorized as a colonial war. So we started there. So that's the first category. But then we look at the fatality numbers on both sides. So to be considered a war in this data set, the conflict has to have at least 1,000 battle-related fatalities within a 12-month period. And this violence obviously does meet that threshold. But there's a secondary element of it, which has to do with both sides have to have be able to mount effective resistance against the other. It's not just shooting back. They have to be able in some way to damage the other side. If there's more than 1,000 deaths and one side can't do that, then we don't call it a war. We call it a massacre or one-sided state violence. And the way that that's operationalized in the data set is that the weaker side in a conflict has to be able to inflict at least 5% of the battle deaths that it incurs on the stronger side. And any less than that, we don't call it a war, we call it a massacre. So we look at the fatality numbers in this conflict to date. And, I should also say that it's really devastating doing this kind of research with these numbers and just plugging in numbers and every day watching them go up. And, we know every single number here is a person's life. And every person that dies has ripple effects of trauma and loss and mourning. And so, you know, doing this kind of analysis by the numbers is not meant to in any way, in any way undersell the importance of that, of the human aspect of this. Again, it's meant to ground this in some sense of reality when the heightened emotions that go into this violence can send us in all these different directions. And so, you know, just basically adding up the numbers, you know, Israel, the best guess estimates that we had at the time we wrote this, which is about a month ago, or at least it was published a month ago, that we wrote it, actually, we started writing it in October, and that's a whole other story of getting this thing published, which is maybe worthwhile. But at the time that it was published, the best estimates say that about 1,139 people were killed in Israel by the Hamas-led attack, including 695 civilians, Israeli civilians, 71 foreign civilians, and 373 Israeli soldiers. And since that time, the Israeli military says it's lost, it had, again, at the time, lost 246 soldiers in Gaza, and estimated that 31 hostages had been killed in Gaza as well. So totaling that up, it's 1,416. And as of the writing at the time, the best estimates in Gaza were that just over 30,000 Palestinians had been killed. And Israeli estimates say that between 1,000 and 1,500 Palestinians were killed on October 7 in the fighting. And so taking the conservative estimate there, 31,000 at the time, and just plugging in the numbers, the Palestinian deaths amount to, the Israeli deaths amount to 4.5% of the Palestinian deaths. So short of that threshold that we would consider it war. Now, we put the data through all kinds of, we say, okay, let's look at the most conservative. Let's look at just the military fatalities, not the civilians, and only the numbers reported by Israel. The result is about the same. So, you know, however you slice it, this does not meet that crucial criteria for effective resistance. And that's a really important one because, you know, it emphasizes that in violent conflict, power disparities really matter, for how we understand what's happening. In this case, it doesn't meet this criteria as this data set laid it out for warfare. And it's also worth saying, by the way, that, it's not unique in that way. If you look at the fatality numbers from all the fighting between Israel and Palestinian groups going back to 2007 after Hamas took control of Gaza, it's almost identical, the percentage for all Palestinians. If you narrow it to Gaza alone, fighting in Gaza, it's about 1% of the people who were killed in Gaza, about 1% Israeli fatalities. And so, you know, what you're looking at over time, putting this particular escalation of violence in the context of the overall conflict, none of the escalations in violence since Hamas took control of Gaza would be called wars, properly speaking. They'd be classified as massacres. And then the third thing we look at is the dynamic between soldiers and civilians. And so what you see in this case, and this relates to the other two as well, it just has to do with the power disparities. But obviously, Hamas and other allied groups were able to breach the security fence that encloses Gaza on October 7 and kill hundreds, more than 1,000 Israelis. It's something that is entirely unprecedented in the history of this conflict. Obviously shocked Israel and deeply, you know, damaged and traumatized the Israeli national psyche. This, you know, we can go all into that. But it was an exceptional event in the history of the conflict. And it was largely due to the fact that the Israeli military had pulled a significant amount of its troops off the border with Gaza and redeployed them into the West Bank to defend the settler project there. And also had ignored multiple intelligence warnings that there was an attack of this kind being planned, and so left themselves very vulnerable to this. That's something that absolutely happened, and which absolutely could not be repeated now. Now with a secured border, Hamas has no ability to damage Israel proper. They can launch rockets. They launch thousands of rockets. But Israel is well protected by the Iron Dome anti-missile system. Almost all of the rockets that actually do land in Israeli territory land in the middle of nowhere. most of these are unguided rockets. And Hamas really has no ability to actually damage Israel proper. Conversely, Hamas has no ability to protect any part of Gaza from Israeli air power. They hide their combat troops in tunnels. They can ambush Israeli forces. They can do damage to the Israeli military, but they can't damage Israeli civilians or protect their own civilians. Whereas you have in the Israeli military, a modern conventional armed forces, that's fighting an irregular force, in Hamas, that can at the same time, kill civilians and destroy civilian infrastructure at will. Hamas has no ability to protect any part of Gaza or its civilians from Israel. And with the borders closed, they also can't move civilians out of harm's way or provide aid. Even, as we say, even if they had the will to do that, they're completely unable to do that. We hear a lot about the use of human shields. And again, that's an accurate way of describing a lot of Hamas's activities. But at the same time, they also don't have much of a choice. There's nowhere to hide except for underground, and they can't move the civilian population underground. So what you have is this extraordinarily asymmetric fighting, where you have a modern, conventional, well-funded military on one side fighting an irregular force on the other side, in a territory that's entirely controlled by the state, with civilians on one side only being completely exposed to violence. So you add all this up and you you can say that there's a lot of things about this conflict that are very complicated. There's competing narratives and histories. And again, all that's important, but there's also things that are very clear, empirically clear. When you look at those elements of it, again, we say, if you're going to use an appropriate word for this, pending a court's decision on the term genocide, which, by the way, doesn't mean we can't use that term if that's what we see happening. But pending that being sort of an official ruling, a massacre is a more appropriate term than war.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's like a very important thing to lay out here. And like on that, I think one thing that's really significant about, this quantifying it in this way, putting it out there in this way, is that, a lot of the conversation that you have in American media is about this question of Israel's right to defend itself. But I think when you frame it, there's a kind of truism, right? Does a nation have a right to defend itself from attack, right? Sure. But what is the context? What are we talking about actually? In this context, I think that it's really important to lay out, that there's a lot of implications here. We are saying that this is not a conflict of equivalent forces. It's not even a conflict of equivalent, like, agencies or institutions, right? One thing is a state, and another is something that doesn't control its own borders, doesn't control its own currency, can't control food that's coming to the region. This creates, a lot of serious moral, ethical, and political questions. And I'm curious, to hear, like, with this kind of finding, with this kind of definition here, what are the responsibilities of, say, like, a United States or international bodies when they're seeing something like this ongoing?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this conclusion that we should call this a massacre instead of a war is not going to come as a great surprise to many of your listeners, surely. It really didn't to us either, as authors. But the purpose of this was to serve as a tool, as something we can use, whether it's with policymakers, whether it's with, any sort of decision-making institutions, editorial lines in different publications, to say, like, look, yeah, let's have open debate. Let's talk about all this, but let's ground this in some empirical reality. Let's talk about what's going on. If you want to then go on and defend, again, the right to, for Israel's right to destroy Hamas or whatever, you go right ahead, but do it acknowledging the facts here. Do it acknowledging the proper terminology for what's happening, and then go on and go on the record doing that, by all means. But again, we do need to, it is important to use appropriate terminology, the hope is that that can just continue to push toward the what we've all really seen from the get-go is that we need a ceasefire. We need an immediate and permanent ceasefire. And, you know, the United States, speaking from my own, you know, from my own opinion, I think has, as it's obviously not done nearly enough. That's just obvious. But at the same time, U.S. policy has shifted more in the past 5 months than it has in decades before that. And that's almost entirely due to everyday people pushing, to, you know, activists, to organizers, to, you know, few brave people in those positions of authority that are taking a stand. And so, you know, the more we can keep, we can sort of ground our language and our reality and what's actually happening, I think the closer we get to stopping the violence.
Truly. And I mean, you mentioned, and I'm just curious if you did want to share, you know, you had some difficulty in getting this out. And I think that that is something that has been very, you know, notable for a lot of folks covering this, you know, how even us, you know, we own our own platform, right? But we get into trouble with, you know, if not direct kind of censorship, like, no, there is an active attempt, for example, to lower the reach of a video, for example, on YouTube about Israel and Palestine. So I'm very curious to hear, you know, your experience with getting this out.
Well, yeah, I mean, it was really, it was an educational experience. I credit to my co-author, James. The idea initially came from him, like, a decade ago or something. I think it was the 2014. It was one of these escalations, one of these bombing campaigns that Israel has in Gaza, that, you know, the media was calling a war. And he had said, you know, I don't think this would actually, he and I both work with the Correlates of War data set in the past. So this is sort of a common language. And he was saying, you know, I don't think this actually meets the criteria for war if you plug in the numbers. And he got some advice from, you know, from people in the foreign policy world that was like, don't say that out loud, basically. You know, when October 7 happened, you know, we obviously were both shook, as were a lot of people who saw what was coming. We talked and we said, okay, like, let's put this together. And the initial idea was meant to be preventative. It was like, look, if you look actually going back to when Hamas took over Gaza, if you look at the casualty counts in all of these military campaigns that Israel had, and you add it up, and then you look at this, and you look at the amount of people who've just been killed in Israel and the reaction that's happening, we're going to see tens of thousands of people dead in Gaza if we don't intervene now. And so the idea then was to be like, the U.S. has to do something now. This is going to get to that point. And we had some very odd, like, initially positive reactions and then not so much so from publications. It was actually accepted at US News, and we went back and forth. They were going to run it as like a big feature, and we went back and forth with an editor there, you know, till it was basically finished. And it was like, all right, we just have to put it on the calendar to publish it. And this was like early November, and we just didn't hear back from them. And, you know, we checked back in at some point, like, hey, what's going on with this? And it was, oh, sorry, we're delayed. We'll get back to you. Another few weeks go by. We kept following up. Eventually, we got this really bizarre email from an editor, which was like, sorry, this is a great piece. We've had some editorial turnover, and we can't really, like, this is really good. And we're not saying no, but we can't tell you when it'll run. So maybe you should look elsewhere. It was like this strange, like, it's not you, it's us kind of thing. But like, if anyone, you know, anyone in the publishing world is like, you know, politeness and diligent communication are not always, you know, virtues that editors, put on display. If someone's going to reject something, you just never hear back 9 times out of 10. Or if you do, it's like you're lucky to get a terse, like, we're passing. So getting this was interesting. It was like, so what's actually going on behind the scenes? And between that and then, you know, months and months and months, and, you know, I don't have to belabor the whole thing, but there was a lot of weird conversations, and eventually it came out in this publication, Inkstick, which is relatively new, meant to be like foreign policy for a popular audience. And, you know, we're both happy with that, but like in a sort of better late than never kind of way. But based on this and also other experiences I've had trying to write things on this particular moment in other public, like more mainstream publications. The sense I get, and this is worthwhile, I think, for the left, because we can, understandably, we can get inside our heads about, like, if things aren't being accepted in the mainstream, it's because the mainstream, we're fighting against institutional power, which is you know, true. And so, but it can be very easy to just see it as like they're rejecting it because they're on the other side. And in this case, I think that's not always the case. I think a lot of people in positions of control, like editors, for example, anyone who the buck could stop with them, anyone who it might come back to them, a lot of these people don't know what they're allowed to say and what they're not. They have this sense that they're like in a minefield, but they don't really know where the mines are. They see people getting fired over here. They see people saying really egregious things over there and not. They see money coming out, like big money coming out of universities. Or, you know, being withdrawn from universities. And so they have a sense that, like, if I fuck up, this could have real consequences, but I don't know what I'm allowed to do. And so that leads to a conservative mentality, and that ends up reproducing the sort of, like, status quo language. But I don't know that it's always intentional that way. And I think that's important to remember, because there's a lot more sympathy for the pro-ceasefire calls than it would seem. Not just in the public, but also in people in some of these positions. And so that was the goal of publishing something like this was trying to help push that, trying to help be like, this is justification to like, no, this is what it looks like. Despite all this other stuff you might be hearing, like, this is what's going on.
Yeah, I mean, it might be nice if David and I could just convince everyone with YouTube takes. But yeah, I think having something like this, I want to, just before we let you go, hear a little bit more about this Correlates of War database, because I appreciate what you said about, like, the dealing with the human actual reality of these numbers. And actually, like, talk a little bit more about this database outside of what it means for, like, I mean, you're basically stewards of this information and putting it to use in the real world in a kind of an urgent way. Just to reflect on that a little bit and tell us a little bit about the database.
Yeah, thanks for asking that. That's really important. And, you know, I think data sets are really good for some things. I'm actually very skeptical of the overuse of data in the social sciences. People sometimes kind of have a penchant for just believing something because the numbers say it and thinking that's truth. We know that it has to do with how the data is collected, how it's organized. And so I'm actually skeptical of that in a lot of instances. Here, I think it's really important because, you know, it's a good place to start to, again, to like agree upon a certain set of facts. Because if something's wrong with it, you can go back to the source. It's not about narrative. You got to decide at some point what number to put in what cell in the data set. And that's like, there's some transparency to that. So it felt like an important place to start here. The reason we use the Correlates of War data set, again, this is one we have both used. It had in the past been, by that I mean like a decade or more ago, the industry standard for data on armed conflict. It kind of fell out of favor a bit, and I think there's reasons for that that are actually relevant to this. But what it was trying to do was trying to differentiate wars proper, like, you know, World War II is a classic, that's a war, from the increasing instances of violent conflict that didn't quite seem to be that. And, you know, this was in the 80s. The categories that we're working with were first published. Trying to work with, okay, like, we're seeing this different stuff. How do we separate one from the other? Right, that was kind of an idea. And let's like catalog the wars so we can compare, you know, apples to apples. And I think, so the data sets that are used more commonly now, it's still used, but more commonly are data sets like one called Uppsala, based on the city where it's based, where they stop trying to define the types of conflicts and they just catalog instances of violence. So they have one for armed violence, like armed conflict. So any single node instance of like two armed groups fighting each other counts there. They also have a separate one for one-sided violence, or what we're calling like a massacre, where it's armed people shooting civilians. Now, the consequence of this, on the one hand, this is better data if you want to do really granular analysis of a conflict. You can see, because like this one, for example, would have hundreds of data points in both, right? And they could even be on the same day. So this does allow you to get more in depth on some things, but it also, you also can lose the forest for the trees here, right? It's probably not an accident that it stopped being popular to try to like categorize the wars right around the time of like the U.S. War on Terror, which is like, doesn't really count, does it? But like, there's not going to be so easy to get funding or get promotion for an argument like that. We'd rather categorize specific instances and talk about that. So that's at least one reason why I think it fell out of use a bit. But you know, we weren't using it for the actual data in it. We were using it for the categories that it set out, because that seemed like it made sense for our purposes.
Right. That's fascinating.
Well, Ben, I really appreciate you coming on here. Let us know if there's anything else that you wanted to add. We definitely need to get you back on to talk about resistance and nonviolence sometime in the near future. I know that's something that you have a lot to say on as well. Really appreciate you spending some time with us today, friend.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Yes, folks.
Yep. No joke. I mean, I do highly suggest people go and take some time to read that piece in its entirety. It's not actually too long. It's very accessible, yeah. And I think an important.
And it is like, sorry to cut you off. Go ahead.
No. I was just saying it's an important contribution.
Yeah. No. I mean, I've been consuming a lot on the history of the region and but it is very useful, I think, to ground it into categories like that. This is to the extent that social sciences can be objective. This is how it's done. Mm-hmm. And, you really see the importance of it when, Wikipedia, the official categorization, and I think that is a pretty good proxy for how these things are registered broadly, is the Israel-Hamas war. Unless I'm mistaken, maybe that's updated now, but that's what it was like a few weeks ago when I first saw this article. But that's a huge problem, because that really frames the 2023 Israel-Hamas war. Yeah.
I think you're seeing in this country a lot of people sort of opening up and learning a lot. But, one of the kind of pop consensus, again, yeah, is one of like a conflict of equivalence and one of, this ancient religious dispute, between these two people. And it's just like, nothing could be further from an accurate portrayal of what is actually going on than that perspective.
Yeah, and I will just to be fair, that there's actually a subhead that's the Israeli invasion of the Gaza Strip. So, colonial massacre would be our preferred categorization, but I guess it's better than just Hamas war. But that just goes to show how much. Needs to be done on this sort of stuff. And it really is like, it's institutional actors who aren't all like in the bag, but who are risk averse, who are in a industry that has basically decided Zionism is a project that we accept. And, a lot of people have, we have to, in this industry, and like I was lucky because Michael and Sam are both, Sam wouldn't consider, he doesn't like to consider himself any ism, but Michael, we are very critical of Israel nonetheless. And Michael was an anti-Zionist himself. If I wasn't in that position where I had two models that professionally directly above me, I like to think like my reading broadly would have brought me to the point where I am now, but I'm not 100% convinced about that at all. I think I definitely benefited from that. And it's a shame because, you see how this happened. I mean, we played the old clips of Edward Said and how he was treated, right? Mm-hmm. Where was it Phil Donahue is like, it's just everything of stopping short of like picking up his shirt to make sure he didn't have a bomb on him. We've come a long way, baby, and it still is leading to us having to watch a genocide and feeling kind of impotent about mm-hmm. How do we actually stop this from continuing.
No, 100%, and there's a lot more on that. Folks, join us for a little bit, patreon.com/leftreckoning in the post game. We'll be going live about 20 minutes or so. We've got some fun stuff. Hang out, take some questions from all of y'all. It really does help us continue to do this show and shows the sport. And we also have a lot of fun on the other side. So if you've never jumped over, why not this this week? Patreon.com/Left Reckoning. We'll be over there in about 20 minutes. Thanks, Matt. Thank you, Ben. Thanks, everybody. And we'll see you on the other side.
Peace.